Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri. And with me today is Eugenio Dominguez, who's an associate professor in the College of Education at my alma mater, Michigan State University. Eugenio, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are going to be talking about an article that has recently come out by Eugenio and two colleagues. It's in ZDM, Mathematics Education. And the article is entitled Young Philosophers, Fifth Grade Students Animating the Concept of Space. And so, Eugenio, I wanted to start with you and your co-authors and let you sort of tell us a little bit about how you came to collaborate on this article, but also just be in a relationship of collaboration with these two other educators. And tell us a little bit about the context here of the Spanish immersion school that you were having experiences and encounters in.
Right. So first, you know, I would like to express a lot of respect, gratitude, and everything positive to my co-authors, Sofia Abreu and Melvin Peralta. They are wonderful philosophers, you know, themselves. So this work has been crafted with their help, with their collaboration, and also with the wonderful ideas of the fifth graders in that beautiful hour that we shared. And also, you know, a great thanks to the student's teacher who had a collaboration with me. You know, she and I had a longer collaboration that extends back, you know, when the pre-COVID, right? I was visiting her classroom every Wednesday as part of my service to the university. But also, you know, I was doing that kind of collaboration because I always find that, as perhaps I'm not exaggerating here, but you know, it's the most fulfilling aspect of my work, being close to a real practice in a real space, in real time, with the real pressures, you know, that sort of like surround that practice of teaching and learning. I am the happiest when teachers, you know, allow me to be part of their practice, right? So I was co-teaching. I was a co-teacher with that teacher. I think we were together. We were learning. We were learning about these concepts. We were learning, and we still are, by the way, we still are learning. She is right now part of my current project. But we are still learning to change the mathematics. I would say about probably half a decade ago, that's when I started shifting, you know, my perspective, you know, and it really changed in how I approach the teaching of mathematics, in how I do research in mathematics education, shifting from this idea of trying to change the human being, in this case, trying to change the professional, the teachers. Or, you know, there are other research projects, right, that the aim is to try to change the students, right? I realized that, you know, that was pretty much a waste of my energy. I mean, who likes to be changed? Right, we have to have some kind of like a motivation coming from inside, coming from within, right? And so, so like I said, probably about half a decade ago, my focus in the research that I do and in the teaching that I do is to change the subject, to change the mathematics. And so this collaboration has grown more and more into a communal desire to change the mathematics. And the beautiful aspect of this new approach is that, you know, what I have found in the U.S. and where I am right now in Oaxaca, in Mexico, is that I find students to be the strongest allies for, you know, this desire to change mathematics. So that's sort of like the nature of my collaboration and a little bit of how I do these collaborations.
Yeah, and I think the article will illustrate some of the things you're talking about, because There's a unit that is starting in this class with fifth graders about plotting points, sort of coordinate plane, introduct like that sort of thing. So maybe a lot of us can imagine a very standard way of teaching the plotting of points. But you approached it differently. So maybe you can say a little bit about how you approached this unit. And then what did that sort of release from the students, or what kind of encounter did that let you have with the students and their thinking? Because that becomes kind of part of the heart of this article is what ideas come out from the students when given the chance to explore this concept of space. And then in the article, you kind of connect those to some other ideas from philosophies, from feminist theory, from other, like you put these fifth graders' ideas into dialogue with some of the deep thinkers of the past or from other fields and things. So take us into that unit, into that approach to space that you had with these students.
Yeah, so I remember, that morning, the teacher and I used to text each other sometimes, same morning, right, of the teaching day, right? So that morning she texted me and she said, I'm going to start a unit on teaching how to plot points. And she wanted to be part of a new perspective, a new way of understanding that concept, right? So I sensed that, right? And I said, well, the first thing that I felt is this resistance to what you said, Sam, right? Like, what's the easiest way, right? Like to pretty much tell the kids the X goes first, right? And then you plot the Y, right? And then everybody's going to be bored, beginning with me, right? So I remember forcing myself because, hey, I am part of that kind of teaching and learning, right? So it wasn't that different for me, but I think it's very important, to find people with whom you can make a difference, right? And embrace that difference. So I refuse to go that traditional, route. I sort of sense again because based on my relationship with the teacher, I knew she wanted something more ambitious, something better, for the students and also for herself. And so and I include myself in this experience. I learn a lot from children in the classroom. So I said, well, I think what's really important, in this school sort of like procedure, right, is the concept of space. I wanted to bring something to them that we all could move, right, and something that could also promote movement among ourselves, right, movement of our bodies, our hands, our limbs, and everything, right. And so I went to my basement and I constructed a tiny, tiny little plane with two sticks crossing each other, glue them together. And then I remember preparing sort of like a couple of questions or maybe one question. I think the questions that I asked him was something like, who do you think has a better sense of space, a rock or a seagull? Where did those questions come from? Who knows? They just somehow I had that encounter with those questions, right? And so I don't know, maybe from some of my favorite albums, right, from the 80s, Flock of Seagulls, who knows, right? maybe from taking a vacation with my husband Jeff to the Upper Peninsula where there's like these picture rocks, right? Like, and seeing the seagulls and all of that. It's like I said, who knows, right? And it's Michigan, right? So it's like, yes, they will know rocks and seagulls, right? And so yeah, so that was the my preparation for that morning, right? What I was not prepared though was the depth of the philosophical understandings from these young philosophers. I think after that 1 hour of this beautiful conversation with them, all of them were on the floor, some of them were sitting on the sofa. I was like leaning against the little, kitchenette area and the sink in the classroom. But after that hour, or maybe the next day, who knows, but that word came to mind, right? Like, these are philosophers. These are not students. These are philosophers, right? And they were so and so respectful. I remember, like voices rising and, emotions stirring and, but the beauty of that moment is that they were sort of like managing their own turn, taking, like silencing each other because they wanted to hear the next idea. So it was just like a very, very intense, moment in that morning.
Yeah, and just going right along with that, let's get into some of the deep ideas that they had because they had this opportunity to just talk about space and share ideas and dig in this deep thinking kind of way rather than just immediately going to a procedure or something that they need to practice. So in the paper, you make several connections to how these ideas from the students are connecting to various parts of philosophy, feminist theory, indigenous knowledge. Maybe we can just take a few different themes. The article will have more of it, but you have a section that's on space and multiplicities. What were some of the students' ideas that kind of were wrapped up in that sort of section of it?
So the idea of multiplicity is something related to the possible and how inquiring about the possible sort of like releases all these multiplicities, different ways of, understanding a concept, a mathematical concept, what Deleuze, de Freitas, Sinclair, and many others, right, referred to as the virtual, right, the virtual that lingers around everything, including mathematical concepts. And the students in that space that morning, they were generating, sharing, encountering these multiplicities, but in a way that, I mean, it really amazed me. For instance, I remember when one question that one student raised was, I always, she went like, I need to ask this question. She's like, there may not be an answer for it, but I'll ask anyways. I said, go for it. And so she's like, how was space created? Has it always been there? And she was also questioning that. And she was like, for me, everything has to be start somewhere, right? So I'm not sure if space has always been there. And so, so that immediately sort of like released some kinds of understandings about space and creation, creationism. But I remember, others, including I, were like, well, that's just one story. But there are many other stories, and let's talk about other stories. And that, that way of discussing these mathematical concepts really filled that space with these multiplicities that were attended to, discussed, but in a way that, I could only compare that to how professional philosophers, must develop and think about and discuss those ideas, right? These young learners were very professional in their mathematical and philosophical conversations that morning.
Yeah. And it seemed like they took each other's ideas seriously. I know I remember in the article, it talks about recognizing that space is sometimes one thing, but then you can kind of reframe it and space can be something else. And so there's this multiplicity of what that word can mean as well. Like if the kids were talking about themselves in the room, they're like, well, we could say there's space between us. But then you can also realize, well, there's also still air molecules or oxygen and things in that space. So it's not like totally devoid. But then they could change the frame or change the context to be like outer space. And then they'd be like, okay, there actually you maybe have a space that doesn't even have gas molecules in it. And so realizing that in one context, space just means, the distance between us, but then in another context, the space can mean actually a void or an emptiness. And to me, just the fact that they were able to handle, or not handle, but that they could talk about this term having different interpretations in different contexts is kind of a big thought rather than every term having like a specific meaning for all times and all places or something. And that the other students seem to take up that idea and then respond to it and add to it. So they were kind of taking each other's ideas or ponderings seriously in conversation.
Yeah, and it's almost like every turn that, collectively we took, I could hear the resonance between their ideas as a group of fifth graders and the beautiful ideas, the beautiful philosophies, that I have been reading for years. So it was almost like, hearing sometimes even a better version, right? A version that was perhaps expressed more eloquently, coming from their voices, right? Their intonations, right? Their force, right? It was resonance, right? It was not the same, right? But it was a very strong resonance with feminist perspectives, with indigenous knowledges, with post-humanism. One student said, sort of like gave, I can't remember exactly what the student said, but gave adjectivity to a rock, saying something like the rock can see us or something. And then another student said, but rocks cannot see us because they don't have brains. And then she said, and how do you know? Right. And so this sort of like beautiful versions, resonances of ideas that I have only read, right, in writings. So it was just like one resonance after another, right, at every turn, at every moment in our discussion. It was just like so beautiful.
Speaking of beauty, there was also a theme that you highlighted about space and aesthetics, and then also criticality. I wonder if you want to just comment on any of the instances or the moments that related to aesthetics or criticality.
Yeah, so in our project, we are fortunate to have Natalie Sinclair. And so I personally have been learning a lot from her writing and her feedback, right, to our project on about aesthetics. I think there may be a sort of like narrow way of understanding aesthetics as something pleasing, as something beautiful, right? But aesthetics is actually, it refers to the responses to these kinds of encounters, right? Between different matters, right? It could be human, it could be more than human materials encountering, and in that process, generating responses. So that's the aesthetics, right? So it may include things like very strong disagreements or finding something, highly disagreeable, right? Or it could be that moment of, feeling, experiencing something beautiful, something sublime, right? Something unexpected. So I think in that morning, the responses that our conversations generated were also filled with those aesthetic situations. But again, what I will always remember, again, right, to bring it back to the aesthetics dimension of this, is how we all managed to go through these responses in a way that it didn't prevent us from developing, from moving along these ideas and sharing these ideas in a very beautiful way. I would not say that, I mean, yes, there were tensions, right? But I'm not sure if I'm ready to use the word frictions, right? But it's more like tensions, right? In terms of various ways of making sense of space. And I think, in this varying of understanding space, that's where the learning occurs. So another, to bring another aspect of this article, this idea of diffraction, right? So one of the things that I have been doing in my analyses is learning to diffract. It could be different, in this case, right? Different philosophical understandings. It could be diffracting two different theories. It could be diffracting a practice with a theory. And I really am interested in diffraction, not in reflection, right? Because diffraction, right? The someone from physics, right? Like Karen Barad, right? So she uses the example of waves. It could be water, it could be sound, it could be light, right? And these are different, two different waves at least, right? At least two that meet and create these new unexpected patterns. And so it is in this newness, right, of this new pattern that new knowledge can emerge, that new knowledge can be appreciated and developed, as opposed to just reflection, right? So the critique about, reflective thinking, reflective learning is that reflection gives us pretty much more or less the same of an image or an idea or a construct, right? So that's one thing that my graduate students in some courses, right? When we read these kinds of, reflective analysis, sometimes they go like, after reading these findings, it feels that we already know what these findings are saying, right? So, and I mean, it's the result of, applying codes and developing themes, and which, in my view, is a way of reducing all these diffractions, right? Or actually ignoring the diffractions that happen, whether we like it or not.
It's interesting to think about. This is when you start making connections to philosophy and then taking ideas to some of these deep places, you just never quite know what encounters you might have between ideas and stuff. So that's interesting. Even happening here to me is kind of interesting to see that. Before we leave the article, I do want to also mention you have like the last section that talks about spaces as extensive and intensive. And this is where you do get into some physical experiences with the students where they have a grid and they're moving a toy around a grid. And so you can kind of talk about the horizontal movement, the vertical movement. But it's interesting though that, with these fifth graders, because they have a lot of these thoughts and caring about space and exploring the space, that they're also going like to the Z axis, like actually coming up off of the grid and the excitement of that three-dimensional sort of realm to it. And to me, this was just thinking about like the profound places that this conversation can go. Instead of just teaching, plotting an X, plotting a Y or something, it's more like you're exploring that whole space and you're now the students are ready and eager to actually talk about the third dimension as well and not just like flat on a piece of paper. But maybe do you have any final thoughts about that part of the encounter with the students?
I learned a lot, from reading Delanda's book, Intensive Science, Virtual something philosophy. I can't remember. Yeah, Delanda proposes that these two ways of making sense of space, the extensive understanding versus the intensive understanding, right? So we all know that school curricula, I would say everywhere, favors the extensive, right? The turning this connected space that we create with movement, that we create as soon as we, right? As soon as we get up, as soon as, we start walking, right? Or other beings, right? Swimming or flying, right? But there's this desire, right? To measure everything. Everything having an origin, everything having a beginning and an end, right? So Delanda says that these two concepts or conceptualizations can actually coexist. So what I took from that wisdom is that all these ideas in the mathematics curriculum in public schools will probably stay here for a few more decades. So yes, but really the responsibility and responsiveness that I felt that morning was to invite the students and the teacher into this other conceptualization of space, which is the intensive, right? The connected, the fluid, the untamed, the space that happens no matter what we do. You know, we can invent measuring tapes, we can invent all kinds of tools, right? Here in Oaxaca, I've been listening to the radio because I don't have my better stereo here, right? And so radio people say it's right now, it's exactly 9:20. Right? It's like, how can they make those statements, you know, about time, right? That is connected. Yes, the models of extensive time and extensive space are everywhere, right? And so my response that morning when the teacher invited me was, can we bring these two spaces together so they can diffract? And they did. They diffracted with the students, with their bodies, with the materials, with everything. And so that's how this article was put out in ZDM.
And if people do look at the article in ZDM, you might be surprised to see that there are comic book panels or comic illustrations of some of these encounters, some of the interactions between people, and it's just woven right into the sort of reporting of the interactions and the quote unquote findings, of a typical article. I enjoy reading comic books, but I have never, I don't think, seen the detail and the illustrations like were in this article in an academic paper. So that was another way of bringing to life this inquiry and sharing this story. I want to just finish on the article with, what's the idea that you would hope comes out into the field or comes out into people who've read this article? What would you want them to take away from it?
So, you know, following on the dimension of bringing comics, right? So the decision to use comics, I think, is a response to bring expressivities that the linear, you know, the linearity of language in any language, right? In any direction, right? The language tends to be linear. It's our way, you know, my co-authors and I, you know, it's our way of reminding our audiences that for so long, right, we have been following these models, right, that are linear, these models of teaching and learning mathematics that are masculinist. These models that sort of like compartmentalize our experiences, right? And so I think the page, this is something that I learned tremendously, you know, from Sofia Abreu, who is the artist who basically created this comics, is the agentivity, right, of a page and how the page filled with lines, with different thicknesses, different shapes. Sometimes, you know, a frame sort of like dripping into the next frame, right? And so just the whole composition, the visual composition, the movement of their eyes and faces and fingers, right? How that can be expressed in drawing, right? I think it's a way of inviting expressivities that I feel that, you know, these expressivities are needed for this way of conceptualizing space as intensive, right? So a work of art, right? When we see a Siqueiros, when we see a Rivera, right, is a whole thing, right? Is a whole thing that grabs us. It's not just one stroke, one color, right? It's the whole thing, right? And so what can this whole page, right, communicate or express, right? And so that was the motivation for using comics.
Yeah, I think for me that is a thing I'm taking away from this work is just the creativity and sort of outside the box kind of thinking to approach scholarly work like this in different sorts of ways. So I appreciate it. It's been a fascinating thing to read and to talk about. Eugenio, before you go though, I have two quick questions that I like to ask my guests just to get to know them a little bit more beyond their academic publications. But
Okay.
Where did you do your grad studies, and what was your experience like in graduate school? I believe you're from Texas, right?
From Texas, yes. Crossed the border, from Mexico. I graduated from the University of Texas at Austin. I learned a lot about cognitive research, children's mathematics, which is a cognitive approach to understanding how children learn mathematics. That was my time, right? And I didn't stay, with in that theoretical paradigm approach, right? I didn't stay too long. As soon as I started doing my postdoc at the University of Illinois Chicago, I started seeing other perspectives, working with communities, right? Mexican American communities, parents and children in Pilsen in Chicago, right? So again, the agentivity, the power of being close to real experiences, real times, and real spaces. It really took me into very different spaces theoretically, but also, in the way that I understand research now.
And my last question is, if you weren't in math education, is there an alternative career that you could imagine for yourself?
I have alternative careers.
That's another way to go about it.
What are my alternative careers? I love cooking. I consider myself a chef, and I love creating cocktails and mixology. So any area that invites creativity, that invites risk-taking, that invites something unexpected, I go that way, right? I think since I was a child, right, I was always, very attracted to the arts, to music, to dance, right? Do I do all those things? Hell yes. Sorry. It's like, I sing, I dance, I cook, I drink, I create, I listen to music, creativity, right? So different ways of expressing, of communicating, of relating, right? So that's the all those are my alternative careers.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I'm glad that you have found ways to infuse that into the mathematics education work as well. So really appreciate you talking about it, and thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it.